You're ready to start the recording. Good, excellent. Right. So, good morning, everyone. I am Kamala Ramprasad De Silva, Chief Executive Officer of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to our session this morning entitled Embracing Digital While Mitigating the Risks. Understanding and managing cyber threats in a rapidly changing world. As most of you know, crisis management plans were activated by most companies when government announced its national stay-at-home initiative to combat COVID-19. Fortunately, some businesses already had an online environment to ensure business continuity. Others, however, had to quickly develop competence and implement remote working plans or face closure. Many companies are now grappling with the challenges posed by work in a virtual world. As we stated before, we at CCGI believe that work is something you do, not a place you go to. Working in the cloud and with the cloud does present new risks. So today, even though those robust risk management strategies, they have to consider new and different cyber risks, which can have devastating effects on data privacy and on reputations. So we thank all of you for joining us as we examine some of the threats facing companies and hear firsthand from experts in the field as they discuss some of the cybersecurity practices which may be put in place to safeguard your processes and privacy in these turbulent times. So, just before we go to the panel, I would like to make a few housekeeping announcements. We would like everyone to remain on mute during the initial panel discussion. You will be invited to make contributions or ask questions. There's an icon at the bottom of your screen to raise your hands when you want to get the moderator's attention. You will need to unmute yourself and then press the mute icon again as soon as you are done to minimize disruptive noises. As always, our technical support is provided by Christy Johnsela Crouch from SmartServe Limited. Christy's services are outsourced and we are very pleased with the really excellent support she provides to the operations of CCGI. So those of you who are new to the environment and would like to get online support for Zoom meetings, you can contact Christy as we did and outsource that service to her. Please note too that this meeting is being recorded and that the recording will be sent to you afterwards by Christy. She will also ensure that the recording is available on the CCGI website and available to everyone. So, to our panel. Today we have a very distinguished panel of speakers. They comprise of Mr. Anthony Zamor, director, one of the directors from PricewaterhouseCoopers, and someone I know is quite an expert in cybersecurity issues, as I've heard him speak before. Mr. Lewis Kinley, co-founder and CEO of Caripay Services Limited, someone who has been assisting CCGI in the background as we moved more into the online environment as well, and we are very appreciative of that. Mr. Selby Wilson, who is a telecom strategist at the Caribbean Telecommunication Union, will be joining us a bit later today. He informed that this morning he had a conference call and will join us as soon as he's done with that. And also on our panel this morning is, of course, Mrs. Claire Gomez Miller, Executive Chairman of Colonial Life Insurance Company Limited, and someone who has tremendous experience with risk management and whose experience today is going to add a lot of value to our session. So also to note for our moderator, the CEO of Virtus Technologies, Mr. Ryan Sterling from Jamaica, is likely to join our discussion later on. And if he does, it would be interesting to get the Jamaican perspective from him during today's session. So I will now hand over to our moderator, the chairman of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute, Mr. Nigel Romano. Nigel, over to you.
Thank you, Kamala. Good morning. And I want to welcome the panelists, Anthony, Louis, and Claire, and hopefully Selby will join us soon. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and yesterday I was listening to the gentleman who is responsible for WordPress, which is like the backbone of a lot of podcasts, you name it, websites, et cetera, et cetera. And he was talking about, so we're very familiar with the distributed ledger and the blockchain technology. Now we're getting much more familiar with distributed work, work from anywhere. As Kamla said, work is not something or somewhere you go to, it's something you do. And he had a very interesting perspective. Now it's not about input. It's not about showing up from 8 to 4 or 9 to 5 or wherever. It's about what you out, but it's about output. In that environment, of course, there are always bad actors who are looking to take advantage of the those who are not too familiar with the whole space. And today we want to look at, while taking advantage of the technology, how do we protect ourselves from those bad actors? And also, how do we protect ourselves from our own ignorance, where we may inadvertently cause harm to the corporation or the organization which we direct? As we know, as directors, as senior managers, we are here to guard the organization, to make sure that its long-term health is solid, that it's over the long term, we continue to create value for customers and clients while capturing value for the corporation. So with that context, I just want to hand it over to Anthony to start off the batting and give us his perspective on the cybersecurity aspects, the risk aspects of this whole distributed work environment. Because I don't think it's going to go away. This is going to be the new normal. So Anthony, over to you.
Thanks a lot, Nigel. And I completely agree with you. I think this is going to be the new normal. And moving forward, we need to think best how we could secure ourselves as well as the organizations we work for. So in terms of the threat landscape in this new COVID-19 new reality, what does the threat landscape look like? The threat landscape in a COVID-19 world looks very similar to the threat landscape in a pre-COVID-19 world, with phishing attacks being the main attacks used against employees and corporations. What has changed is the frequency of these attacks and the way that the attacks are used. So with regards to phishing, what we see is more and more phishing emails going to clients under the pretext of someone being a representative from the World Health Organization or Center for the Disease Control or whatnot. Today, actually, my team and I were planning a phishing attack against a client, and the pretext for that attack is COVID-19 training. So we're going to send an email to all employees of this company, pretext being COVID-19 training. When they click on the link, they'll be asked to log in to fill out a training form, essentially. And once they log in, we seize their credentials. And those types of attacks are exactly the types of attacks that are used in the real world. So what has changed, if not the threat landscape and the tools, techniques, and procedures used by attackers? What has changed is the number of persons working remotely now, the number of persons working remotely, and the use of a lot of remote access technologies means increased risk to organizations. So today, what I want to go through is some of those technologies that are being used, the risk associated with those technologies, and some of the controls that organizations can implement to protect themselves and employees. But before I go into those risks and controls, I want to touch more on phishing, and I want to give you an example of the types or how great the impact of phishing attacks could be. And I like this example because demonstrates or it shows how organizations working from home is at risk. And this example comes from a client of ours, and it happened last year. This client has fairly sizable revenues, but it operates like a mom and pop shop. All the infrastructure used is cloud-based infrastructure. Employees essentially work remotely most of the time, even though an office is available. Banking is done online. So for this particular client, the accountant last year received an email. The email contained a malicious link. She clicked on the malicious link, and the attacker gained access to her computer. The attacker then gained access to her cloud email, Microsoft Office 365. And the attacker essentially read emails for a period of 6 months or so, getting a profile of the corporation, getting to know the type of vendors that she deals with on a daily basis, and the patterns and whatnot. And what that attacker did after that 6 month period of going through the emails was to create a fake email account that seemed to originate or appear to originate from one of the valid suppliers. The attacker then emailed her and asked that wires going forward should be sent to this new bank account. So he essentially said, I changed bank accounts, send wires from henceforth to this bank account. So that was not unusual for this particular supplier. So she complied. So she had to transfer two sizable wire transfers to the supplier, each for roughly 600,000 TT. So she conducted the first wire transfer, online banking again. The CFO of the company, he just approved it because it wasn't a suspicious supplier or anything like that. And within the space of the next 2 weeks, she sent the other wire transfer, and they lost approximately $1.2 million from this one attack. Yeah, so that kind of demonstrates the risk associated with phishing attacks. Most people, when they hear phishing, they don't think about the financial implications, but the financial implications could be significant. So I just wanted to share that story with you. So in terms of working from home arrangements and technologies that's used, there's two common technologies that is used by organizations for remote working arrangements. The first should never be used at all. And the first is remote desktop access. So some organizations, mainly small organizations, use remote desktop, which is an application that essentially gives employees access, remote access, to a server that is on-premises or another computer that is on-premises. This is the weakest technology that could be used for a remote working, and it has several risks, which I'll go into shortly. The second technology or group of technologies that is usually used and should be used by organizations is VPN-based remote access. With VPN-based remote access, employees essentially have a VPN client on their laptop or their desktop at home or their mobile device, and via this VPN client, they connect to services on the company's premises. Email servers, application servers, database servers, or whatnot. So those are the two main technologies that are being used now for remote access. The risk associated with those technologies now, given that much more persons use it, is firstly endpoint remote access. So what we need to do now in this new reality where most employees work from home is to do device audits to make sure that devices where we've installed VPN clients are authorized company devices. And if they are not authorized company devices, then the devices used to connect remotely to organizations should be vetted by the organization before connectivity is allowed. The second main risk that organizations face because of remote working arrangements is the threat of lateral movement. So usually when attackers connect to your corporate network, they want to move laterally, meaning they want to connect to different servers within your environment. So what organizations, with the help of their IT departments, need to do is to set up firewalls that protect critical servers. So if employees work remotely and connect to critical servers in an environment, establish firewall controls that would protect these critical servers from lateral movement. The third key risk as a result of these working from home arrangements is regarding split tunnel and full tunnel availability. So VPN traffic, as it's designed, it's designed only to allow certain traffic, so corporate traffic, as the best practice design. What many IT departments have done to deal with increased traffic as a result of working from home arrangements is to split that VPN tunnel traffic between corporate traffic and web-based traffic. So the VPN tunnel uses both types or could facilitate both types of traffic now. And there are certain risks inherent to that. The main risk being that the web-based traffic may not be filtered as it's supposed to. So that is something that organizations need to look at. And the fourth major risk is denial of service attacks as a result of remote access. With most of our employees working from home, the risk of denial of service attacks has increased. And denial of service attacks are attacks targeting specific individuals using remote access connectivity tools designed to have their accounts invalidated through attempting multiple failed password attempts. So if I were an attacker and I wanted to bring down an organization where most employees work remotely, I would brute force or try multiple passwords using employee email addresses, for instance. And when I try those multiple passwords, the employee accounts are essentially locked out. If most of the employee accounts in the organization are locked out, then most persons can't work, so denial of service, which is a very big risk that we've seen. So in terms of protection mechanisms, what could we do given these risks? One of the highest impact controls that could be implemented by organizations is a control called multi-factor authentication. So usually when we log on to our emails, be it Office 365, Google or Exchange server, Microsoft Exchange server, we do so using a password. Most times that password is non-complex. And if it is complex, it's something that in a lot of cases, it's easy to figure out. Multi-factor authentication uses a password as well as another form of authentication. Sometimes that could be an SMS message. Sometimes it could be an app. So for my accounts, for instance, I have an app where each time I enter my password into my Hotmail account, I get a code that's sent to this app, I type in the code, and then I'm authenticated. So multi-factor authentication is the most significant control that I think could be implemented by organizations to protect themselves now. Second control, device trust. With more persons working from home, we have an increase in untrusted devices. So persons using their personal computers and whatnot to access corporate data. To the extent possible, organizations should implement methods to validate the computers or devices that are used by employees to connect to networks. One of these methods, one of the more popular methods that is used, is having a certificate installed on approved devices. So if I use my personal computer to connect to work servers, I would want my company to validate that my personal computer could be used and install a certificate. The certificate would then allow me to connect to my resources. Another big control that could be implemented is user awareness training. I think this is one of the controls that most persons take for granted. As I said before, phishing is the most prevalent attack vector used, and the best defense that we have against phishing attacks is user awareness. So companies should, as much as possible, rule out user awareness trainings, especially in light of the COVID-19 type phishing attacks we've seen. Sensitize employees to these types of attacks, the risks that they face, and what they can do to protect themselves. Also, with regards to the use of cloud technologies, what we need to ensure is that we enable logs on cloud-based servers so that relevant IT personnel could review access to sensitive resources on the cloud. Most times we go to companies and a basic security tool such as a log is not enabled. And if these auditing logs aren't enabled, then companies have no way of verifying who accessed critical resources and whether the access to critical resources has been authorized. So those, in a nutshell, those are the main risks and the controls. I want to take up too much time. I know there's other speakers, but looking forward to the questions.
Thank you very much, Anthony. That was an excellent start to the proceedings.
Thank you.
Lewis, over to you. What should we be aware of?
Well, Anthony did a great job of getting us started and really laying out. I agree, absolutely, the most common threat is phishing. You know, that's, I think, responsible for the, you know, well above 80% of all data breaches that occur. And it's really, really pretty simple, as he rightfully said, to train your employees, to train your team to stop that. There's one more tool I would throw out there. It's a company from Vancouver, Canada, that's really looked at that problem as it's really hard to know who the bad guys are. You can never know if that email you've received is from somebody that's trying to attack you. It's much easier to know who all the good guys are. So rather than trying to do, you know, malicious screening, they've flipped it and said, here's a list of all the domains and things that we know are good, and we'll just let you know if you should trust this link or whatever it is. The company is called MetaCert. I won't spend too much time plugging them, but it's a really simple browser plugin you can get that really can cut down a lot of that. So that just to kind of tie in with what Anthony was talking about, covered some of the stuff I was thinking about. But you know, I think everybody is working from home now, in addition to being more aware of phishing and getting on VPNs, there are some things that when we were in the office, we would have been more aware of, like, you know, keeping our desk clean, keeping our calls private, where when we're at home, we're a little more comfortable and we probably don't really think about those things. But for sure, there are some folks in this call who, you know, you handle sensitive information for your company. If you leave that out and your spouse or somebody else walks by and sees it, that might violate company policies, right? That clean desk policy, you don't think about that when you're in the office, it's just automatic. And when you're home, it doesn't even cross your mind. But I think that's a big one that we already know that's a risk that we probably have policies in place for, but we should make folks aware of those as their work environment changes, right? So I really wanted to break this up into a couple sections. That's part one is really the risks we know about. So things like phishing, things like a clean desk attack or clean desk policy, you know, controlling your access to your cloud resources. That's all really good. Those open up a lot of risks that we probably weren't aware of and weren't thinking about when we were in the office though, right? There's a lot of those questions of how do you establish access controls to the cloud, right? It's as much or more than, you know, going beyond a VPN. It's does somebody in accounts have access to all of our customer files or just some aggregate information about that they need to do accounting, right? It can be easier for folks in IT to just say, well, accounts needs access to customer information. So let me just give the entire accounts group access to this folder of customer data. But again, that might expose a lot more data than you were prepared for. Whereas, you know, in your physical office, you might have been able to control that access a little easier. So thinking about things like that, that again, you open yourself up to more risk by allowing those folks to access more information from home. And Anthony made another great point, devices, right? That's how do you verify your employees' devices, especially as you think about, you know, they are interacting with your customers, sending and receiving all kinds of stuff on behalf of the company that, again, if one employee's computer is breached, that might expose several of your customers in a number of ways. So really it comes back to knowing who you can trust. In the really the paradigm of phishing, like Anthony mentioned, the attackers spent their time gathering information, right? Not every hack or breach will show up immediately. If you don't have those logs, if you don't have monitoring, you're not gonna know when you've been breached until it's definitely too late and they've chosen to now do something with all that information they've gained. So thinking of how you put controls in place to not only restrict the devices and their access to your networks, but to control how information is shared around. I think that, you know, we see some interesting examples of that as people have rushed to solutions. You know, a lot of companies are now allowing their customers to engage with them digitally. You have to, right? That's to keep the business moving. But when we move that engagement onto WhatsApp, right, you see some good cases of that where groceries are allowing you to WhatsApp in your order and do curbside pickup. That's really, you know, a bonus, a benefit to everyone. Now, in cases where you're allowed to WhatsApp in your prescription, that probably doesn't pass any kind of data security standard or HIPAA anything, and means that a lot of individuals are really sending personal information over insecure channels to wind up on who knows how many devices. So that creates the problem that now if you need to comply with GDPR or any of the data protection acts in the region, really, you need to be able to tell your customers if they ask what data you have about them and where it is. you also have to be able to correct that or delete that. And if that lives on a bunch of devices that your agents or your employees have managed, how do you ensure that all of that is deleted or updated? And I think that that also really should raise questions for us as individuals, though, when a company asks us, you know, to share that kind of personal information, how many places does that wind up, right? If I WhatsApp in my ID to my insurance agent and then WhatsApp in my order to someone else, that's two people that have my personal information when really it should be two companies, right? And if those folks lose a device or have their devices breached, now somebody else has my information that they can use to impersonate me. And especially as we see a lot of, you know, creative ways to engage our customers, a lot of firms are, you know, looking for just how can they continue business as close to normal as possible, right? So it, allowing customers to just email in photos of things. But if my photos have already been shared once and somebody steals those and shares those as if they were me, now, you know, my insurance company might think that's me talking to them, but it's actually not. So as an individual, I think there's a lot we should be thinking about in terms of how broadly our personal information gets shared in these times. You know, in some verticals, it's a little bit less problematic than others. But from a business perspective, you know, if five of your customers lose their information, those stories are going to be very relatable, right? If somebody gets impersonated, that's a pretty big ding to your reputation. You know, even if it's not a large number of persons breached, right? So when we think about how all of our data as a company, as individuals, is being distributed much more broadly, it's no longer just in our office, it's no longer just in, you know, company-owned computers. There's a lot of issues and risks that come up with that. And then when we think about more complex transactions where we might have a customer that needs to go to the doctor and get some information to mail in somewhere, and that might need to get sent off somewhere else, the more touch points we have in those interactions, the more risks are created, the more, you know, participants in that chain we're trusting. Which is, you know, interesting because in the physical world, when we got a document that's been officially stamped or, you know, notarized, at least you could feel that and see that that ink looked real. But when somebody just emails you in a photo of that, it's really almost impossible to know if that's been forged in some way, right? So it's almost as if in this digital world, you know, we need to be thinking about how we just move beyond paper entirely. And rather than relying on photographs, start thinking about how we can, you know, rely on and create digital data from the beginning so that we can really kind of trust the integrity of that over time. And as Nigel mentioned, blockchain, there are a lot of cool, I'm a little bit of a technologist, so I kind of geek out on these things, but there's some really cool stuff that can be applied to make that data much more private and secure and trustable. And really open up new channels for how companies can engage with their customers and create value for their customers. Which really gets me into the third part of what I wanted to talk about, which is just some of the solutions and opportunities to these risks, right? It can be pretty simple. It's good governance. Covers a lot of the risks of employees accessing things and, you know, clean desks and all that. A lot of the problems that we're facing, policies that need to be developed, processes need to be implemented, there are standards already out there for that, right? The ISO, NIST, they've already developed and thought through so many of these things that, you know, there's no sense trying to reinvent most of these things ourselves. You know, any problem you're facing, you should be able to find an ISO standard that addresses it. And just take a glance through and see what they recommend, right? You don't have to go all the way to ISO certification in order to protect your organization. But if you draw guidance from some of those things, that can really help you develop your plans and build your business for the future in a much more stable way. And of course, then if you work towards an ISO audit, then, you know, it might add a little bit more to the perception of value as well. But don't try and do it all yourself, right? Every company has their expertise and their specialties. So you don't want to spend months trying to go out and figure out how to apply some ISO standard when, you know, somebody like Anthony could probably come in and help you figure it out in a week. So, you know, leverage the resources that are available. And really, you know, as you think about securing that chain of data between your customers and yourself as a business and your suppliers, you know, start thinking about what are the weakest points in that? Where do the breakdowns in trust possibly occur? And start finding solutions or identifying solutions to those weak points. Because maybe some suppliers already, you know, you have a Microsoft Teams space that you work with them and share all your documents. So that might be pretty secure, but others, it might be a hodgepodge of WhatsApp and email and who knows what else that you might want to, you know, find a better way. So really, you know, in this new era that we're facing, we can't call on the professionals that we used to call on to help us, you know, deal with the paper and the due diligence and the verification of everything that we would have liked to in the past. So as companies, we need to find new processes and new ways of doing that. And I think that, you know, blockchain and being able to create data from the beginning of a relationship that allows us to trust it for the entire life cycle really alleviates a lot of the risks of trust and phishing and engaging with our customers that, you know, can help build our businesses now in this time to really scale over the next, you know, 10, 20 years. That's really the, you know, the core message of what I want to get across here is that there are a lot of risks. There are a lot of unknowns and things that will come up as we wade through this. But there are also a lot of solutions already out there mm-hmm. that maybe weren't as obvious or as pressing before. But as we start to identify where those major risks to the business are, we can start to find targeted solutions and, you know, really prepare ourselves to go forward. I think I'll leave it there and look forward to some more questions and with the other panelists.
Thank you very much, Lewis. I want you to type in the chat for everybody to see the name of that company. Is it MediCert or whatever? Can you type it in so that we can all see it? Claire, over to you.
Okay, thank you, Nigel. Okay, good morning, everyone. Okay. I like the quotation that the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute stated, which is, work is something you do, not a place you go to. Oftentimes, we have forgotten about that, and we have concentrated all our operations within buildings, far away from the homes of our employees, far away from our executive management team and the board. So now that the risk has actually materialized, which is your global pandemic, and it is affecting every single country right now, it means to say that your supply chain, the your technical support that your custom having, the way you do business has drastically changed. So for the organizations that were prepared, like for instance, those in the energy sector, they would have had a crisis management plan and business continuity plans. They would have had all of those scenarios, and they were able to be nimble enough to respond quickly and continue their operations remotely. They would have had the people, they would have had the software, they would have had the hardware, they would have had all of the combination of the right things being in place. So at this point in time, all organizations, given the fact that this novel coronavirus is pretty new, very fluid, we don't know what is coming at us. We have best practices to follow from your chief medical officer, and the next thing you have your public health legislation that is placing legal restrictions on you. So it means to say that the organization has to respond to this risk that has materialized. So it's no longer planning for the risk to materialize, but really responding to it. And responding to it means for the survival of your organization, and especially organizations that are essential service providers, it means to say you have to respond. So at this point in time, a lot of board directors and executive management would be looking at what should we focus on at this point? And especially the critical first weeks. The critical first weeks is where it's going to be a make or break. So you have to be nimble. Right? So critical questions that the board and executive management team will have to ask are, do we have a crisis management plan or a business continuity plan that addresses pandemic? Right? If yes, it most likely addresses remote work from home. So we would be good at that. If the answer is no, you have to prepare one immediately. You cannot continue your business if it is that you don't have something thought through, customized for your organization that focuses on the right and strategic things, because the businesses have to survive. At this point in time, it's not only the pandemic, but the global recession that you're seeing unfolding. So you're looking at the entire 2020 into 2021, if not the entire 2021, you will have to be facing the critical decisions of how do you sustain your organization. So that remote working has to be critical as we move forward, right? So if it is that we don't have a pandemic business continuity plan, then networking with different organizations can pay dividends at this point, as you can always get a plan that you can customize for your organization along with the experts to guide and advise you, often at no financial cost. So being organizations like the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute ought to be paying dividends. So I'm not plugging for you, Kamla, but I am stating a fact. Those organizations where their professionals, even their directors and executive management, have been isolated in how they operate their businesses and have not been networking within their industries and even outside of their industries, I believe those are the ones that are going to be hampered right now. The next question is, what is our capacity for remote work? And sometimes we concentrate on the computer and communication technology part, but then we forget about the people. Yeah, so we know that we have built in all the capacity for communication. We have the right apps. We can Zoom. We can do a lot of things, etc. But this novel coronavirus, COVID-19, brings its own unique factors that must be considered within the fluid challenges that are faced. And I'm talking about every single day. You listen to the Ministry of Health and your chief medical officer, your national security. Yes, and new challenges are coming at you. But the biggest risk is your essential staff, right? The biggest risk is, what if your essential staff is infected? Do you have the redundancy to quickly replace the staff and your the computer system that you have now placed in their hands? Can you get in there? Yes, can you take that all of all of the hardware, with the software, everything from that location and carry to another location? Do you have the redundancy to maybe just leave it as it is and then equip other staff members with that support? Because if not, then you are going to have a disrupted business. You are going to have a disrupted business. Also, the user awareness. How well have you, your staff been cross-trained in cybersecurity threats, like especially the phishing, right? At Clico, we have been fortunate to have started since 2018, very much into 2019, and we continue into 2020, online IT security training. So fortunately, we have few clickers, as you would call them. And so we have the know before online training. And it's very interactive, and you can assess the organization as to its learning of these IT threats. And it has to be across the organization. And your clickers are automatically enrolled for further repeat training. So you get, you know yourself if it is that you keep getting a lot more training than your other peers, right? So the user awareness have to be inculcated in the organization, right? Equipping and training your workers to work at home. I remembered in 2018 when we had the flooding in Trinidad. I think that was a nice opportunity, an excellent opportunity for the organizations to dust off their disaster preparedness plans. Yes, and some of our workers had to work remotely. So fortunately for us, it was a wake-up call. And I'm hoping that a lot of organizations had used that opportunity to put in certain things in place so that they could have continued electronically from home, right? So training should have been extended to all board directors and management, especially in communication tools, such as your Zoom and your Microsoft team. Now, if it is that they have not been, it is not too late. You can have your, I'm hoping that if it is that you have to take them through, your IT team is present so that they can train remotely the individuals who need to be trained at this point in time. Because as we said before, you're not only preparing for the immediate now, you're preparing for the rest of 2020, 2021. So even those organizations that are behind the curve, you can start, but you need to start now. You need to start now. Next thing is, how strong is the company in managing existing cybersecurity threats? Because as Anthony said before, the threats are the same. It's just that they are more numerous in numbers. It's the same type of threats that you're getting. Phishing will always be there because they expect that when they send out these multi-million of emails, etc., that even if it is 1% response, 1%, it can result in them making, as Anthony said before, you had a $1.2 million loss from one individual. Right? So it is very lucrative. So they will continue, especially as you said before, where it is that you have the remote workers outside there that, who are not seeing the face of the IT team to connect to them, to tell them, look, we need to be more secure. We need to have more security awareness and the different types of threats that's coming our way. What does it look like? And I believe that that continuous awareness must be taken place, even whilst it is that they are working from home. And it must extend to all of the staff. Because as we said before, if the risk that you have, the major risk that you have is the essential workers, the ones that you have equipped to work from home, they themselves have become infected, then it means to say that you're looking at your other layers to take up that responsibility. And if they have not been prepared to do so, then I don't think that they'll be able to respond. So it means to see that you have to assess how many persons, what percentage of the organization, what is support that can quickly slip into some of those essential positions? Do you have that level of redundancy? And how quickly can you rebuild, or I should say build that, and how can you maintain that as you go along, right? So the organizations that would have been prepared would have also, that would have always been inculcating a learning culture within the organization. If you don't have that learning culture, it's, and risk intelligence, it's very hard for you to really and truly come out of the box. As we said before, you have to be nimble. You have to, for your organization to survive, you have to rethink how your organization is operating. Yes? So for instance, those retail organizations, yes, they may be in the essential sector, or they may have element, they may not be, but they may have elements of their business that can be deemed as essential. And as such, can financially succeed within this climate. But if they don't have that technology, then how do they respond? If they don't have the people, you can have all of the technology, but if you don't have the right people, rightly prepared to respond at this point in time, your chances of survival as an organization reduces enormously, right? So what I would want to make sure that everyone takes away from this conversation here is making sure that not only your essential persons are trained, equipped, ready to function remotely, but you go across the organization, you identify your different layers. And also, you must have that networking. As Lewis and I said before, networking with different organizations will pay dividends. At this point in time, you can get all your policies, all your plans, etc., that you can customize. Right? You're speaking of things like your privacy and confidentiality agreements. If you didn't have that in place, you need to get those now. Your clean desk policy must be enforced, not because you're no longer in an office environment, but you now have to take that office environment into your home. So it's a culture change. So if that culture change was not there before, you now need to put it in place, because we are planning not for the short term, but for the long term. So this remote working is not going to just stop when the government says, go back out to work. It's not going to happen that way. It means to say that we have to look at this as a long-term measure, not as for the short term. So the investment in bringing all of your personnel up to date on those the cybersecurity threats remain essential, and putting the right policies, processes, etc. in place is what it is that we now need to focus on, if it is that we did not do so before. I'm awaiting the questions from the participants.
Thank you very much. I see Selby is on and Ryan is on. So Selby, good morning. Thank you for joining us. Selby?
Morning, Nigel. Morning, panel. Very interesting discourse.
Can you share your perspective with us?
Yes, thanks a lot. I see we have very knowledgeable participants.
Yep.
So I will give my two cents worth. I would like to start off by saying that there are five controls which can stop about 80% of the cyber attacks. And those five controls are basically, you must have secure configuration of the equipment on your laptops. You must have a firewall. Access control is key. And we're talking access not only from the users, but what can your computer access? if it's a company computer, patch management procedures, and also malware protection. It has been found that if these five controls are mastered, then you can literally prevent about 80% of the cyber attacks. The other point I'd like to make is, I am not satisfied that the boardrooms are sufficiently concerned about cybersecurity. They see it as another operational risk activity, but it is quite a different kind of operational risk in my view. It is a risk which does not relate so much to your internal controls, but relates to the fact that your systems, your processes, your resources can be accessed externally from any part of the world. And therefore, it makes you very vulnerable. And you've got to be aware of that. You've got to elevate it. The other dimension is what I call the human firewall. We sometimes do not pay sufficient attention to the vulnerabilities of the human intervention and how human beings can be manipulated through these phishing activities to open your networks to malware and to attacks. So I think we need to focus more on the human firewall. How are they trained? How are they refreshed? How are they made aware of all these risks that exist out there? That's one dimension. And I want to move quickly into the question of working remotely. Working remotely now brings in another dimension to the whole question of security. It brings in a dimension of the impact on your employees. It brings in the dimension, are their locations adequate to work efficiently remotely? How are you going to deal with that? We need to talk about the question of isolation of employees and isolation of teams when you work remotely. How do we continue to have that camaraderie as if they were in an office location? And that needs a special kind of management. I need to say that one of the things is not only just simply working remotely, but it also involves being very flexible in how you work, at what times you work. It need not be a set 8-to-4 period. There's a certain amount of flexibility that comes with working remotely to attend to your personal needs, to attend to your children, to attend to your elderly parents or whatever, to do personal things and to do the work. And therefore, it comes down to how are you going to measure the performance of those who work remotely? And I think we need to have a paradigm shift there. Before we measured people, do they come to work on time? Are they putting in 8 hours of work? We now have to shift that paradigm into, are they meeting their objectives? Are they, in fact, delivering results that are measurable? Mm-hmm. You've got to apply SMART to the process. So do you now look at the measurement of outputs rather than input, the measurement of being present? I'd like to pause there, Nigel, for the time being.
Thank you very much, Selby. Short and sweet and very, very powerful. Can you do me a favor and type the 5 controls in the chat box so that everybody can see it? I think that'll be very helpful. And I thank you for also reinforcing the whole question of the focus now has to be on output, not input, not FaceTime or office time. So I think that's very critical. The shift there has to be, how do we have to be a lot more deliberate about the key results we are looking for and how we measure those results so that people are very clear about purpose and what they're going to be doing. I think that's very, very, very good. I know Ryan is on. Ryan, do you want to add anything to the conversation before we go to the questions?
No, I'm just here to learn. I'm taking it all in.
All right, okay. So I'm going to open with the questions, okay? I have a few. So to Anthony or Lewis, Selby, or anybody else on the call, you have software like Dashlane, the Vault Keepers, the Password Keepers. I'd like to get your perspective on that. I'd also like, and I'm just going to go through all one time. I have been using Zoom for like 5 years. And Zoom, there was some press about issues with Zoom. How do you, what should we be concerned about with respect to Zoom? I know they did some fixes. I'd appreciate your take on that. A lot of people are not aware that they can protect a PDF document so that, because if you send me a PDF document, I have software that I can use to change it. So how do we, in a remote working environment where we have a document, what should we be aware of when sharing documents that we do not want to be changed? And to Lewis, I'd like to get his perspective on the solution to the data privacy issues. In other words, is it possible that instead of us having the data is stored somewhere and we access the data as we need to, with that central repository having all the necessary controls in place to ensure that the GDPR standards, et cetera, are satisfied? Those are my... Oh, one other question to Claire. Online commerce. How are you dealing with online commerce? Because customers renewing insurance policies, that kind of stuff. This is not remote working, but remote and distributed selling and settlement. So Anthony, hopefully you can kick it off.
Yeah, sure. Good questions. So with regards to the password keepers, I think, I support the use of password keepers generally, but I think with regards to these applications, two main considerations need to be thought about. The first one being the type of encryption mechanism being used to encrypt the passwords. Mm-hmm. So password keepers, once they type in the passwords, they encrypt the password using some sort of encryption algorithm. There are weak encryption algorithms and there are very strong encryption algorithms. So a strong encryption algorithm would be an algorithm such as MD5 or something called SHA-256. With strong encryption algorithms, if hackers get the underlying file or the underlying database that stores the password, it would be near impossible or take a really long period of time for them to crack that database and get access to your passwords. So make sure that you use a strong encryption algorithm when you're using these password keeper tools. That's the first point.
So just one note. If you can type those two protocols you're looking at, SHA-256 and the other one for us. But go ahead, because we go after you finish talking to us.
Yeah. The second important consideration is where does the password keeper store the database? So knowing that is essential. If your password keeper stores the underlying database file in a location that could be easily accessible by others, then the keeper is useless. It's like having a safe with $1 million that's on Frederick Street. You know, anybody could take the safe, carry it off site, and then take time to crack the passwords and get the underlying data. So those are the two important considerations.
So you have to have a solid, a strong password for your password keeper, for your vault.
A strong password for a strong encryption algorithm for your password keeper, and keep your password keeper files in a secure location.
Okay.
So behind a firewall, if you're on a network, if you use a PC, personal computer, then you could put it in a password encrypted file or store it on a drive, which is encrypted as well. So it all depends on the type of passwords you have. The higher the risk, the more controls you want to implement.
Right.
If it's passwords to, I mean, some benign account, I mean, it's not risky, but if it's passwords for all your online banking accounts, then definitely, or your Bitcoin wallets, definitely you want to secure them. Yeah,
definitely.
With regards
and it has to be a cold wallet, not a hot wallet.
Yes, yes, cold wallet. Yeah.
Zoom
with regards to Zoom, for the Zoom, I think the main considerations for Zoom, given the security issues that have surfaced in recent times, is making sure you use the most up-to-date version of the software. Attackers take advantage of deprecated software versions, meaning older software versions tend to contain bugs, and when the application developers uncover or discover these bugs, they implement patches to fix them. Attackers take advantage of persons not using the most up-to-date versions of software. So if you're using Zoom, given the recent security concerns, make sure you have the most up-to-date version. Second consideration for Zoom is in your settings for your Zoom meetings, you have a lot of configurations that could prevent things like Zoom bombing, which is something that's very popular now. So if I get a Zoom link, I shouldn't be able to access without somebody having to grant me access to the room. So when I click on a Zoom link as a malicious actor, if I have access to just jump in the room without somebody approving me in that room, that is a problematic. And you open yourself up to attacks such as Zoom bombing. The PDF protection question, that's an interesting question. And it's something that is a risk that a lot of organizations face now. With regards to being able to modify PDF documents, it's something that has been happening for years. I think probably one of the biggest controls or the most important controls that could be implemented to protect these types of attacks is encrypting the documents. Also, there are tools that take a hash value of documents. A hash value is essentially a computed mathematical value based on a hashing algorithm. So each document would contain a unique hash value. It's like a fingerprint, right? Mm-hmm. So if I type in a document with a certain verbiage, number of spaces and whatnot, if I compute a hash on that document, the hash value or the unique fingerprint to that document, if that is known and could be compared to another document before verifying or implement software tools that essentially do that, I think that's one of the biggest mechanisms that could be used to prevent the falsification of these electronic documents. And there are lots of tools that essentially do this type of thing. Being a technologist myself, I look forward to widespread adoption of distributed ledger technologies that essentially computes these values for various documents and could help organizations attest to the authenticity of these documents when distributed as well.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful. We have two questions before we go. We have from Where is it? From Kamna to everyone, is OneDrive safe? And what about Dropbox?
Yeah, those, I think those are both safe. It really comes down to the account security of the users, right? Anthony touched on a lot of aspects of that, but generally speaking, if your data is there, it's safe, as your user accounts.
And safe as your password and how you protect that password, right? Okay. And the next one is, could you share what are some of the online cybersecurity training currently available?
There are a lot of those. EdX has some really good, pretty short courses that you can go through. Udemy as well. There's also Khan Academy has several courses.
I'll call you Black.
What's that? What's that, Selby?
Oh, sorry. I wanted to make one other observation, Nigel. And the observation has to do with, you know, how prepared are we for a pandemic? And when I talk about that, I'm not referring only to business places, but even government operations. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this has brought out in Trinidad, at least, is that the government, despite their best efforts, despite the fact that they are making all these social benefits available to people, the very act of doing that is encouraging people to congregate in a closed space to realize those benefits. And therefore, it forces the view, it emphasizes the view that the governments must begin to use technology more appropriately to service their people in the region. That is a must, and this pandemic has brought that home very clearly. You had people going to national NIB offices and being turned away to receive their benefits. Mm-hmm. You had people wanting to pay taxes before the 15th of a month, going to the tax office. It's another exposure. So I hope this is a wake-up call for the governments to begin using the technologies more effectively and providing end-to-end solutions in serving the population.
Well, for me, Selby, it is a real opportunity, and it's not just Trinidad and Tobago, it's global. The two things, the ability to use distributed ledger technology, use payment technologies to get payments electronically and securely to the people that it's supposed to get to is going to be critical here, because it helps one to speed up the process, reduce the cost, and also
improve the convenience,
so that the people who are supposed to get it. And you also have a trail. So if you tell me you spent $10 million on this social, boom, I can have a list of all the people who have got it, and it's in their bank accounts or wherever. So this is very, very critical. And I hope it really leads to a sea change, a real revolution in both payments, how we affect payments and I'm getting clear just now on the e-commerce. But I just want to go back to Lewis, the data privacy issue. What do you think?
Just before you go to Lewis, just for 1 second, I also want to ask if you could address this, because I think what Mr. Selby Wilson raised just now is critical. So if we are talking about asking persons to be able to use the online environment, you know, if you ask someone to share a copy of their ID on WhatsApp, is the encryption and the WhatsApp technology adequate? And if not, then therefore, if we are encouraging government to move to an online environment where they can reach people where they are most needed, what would be the recommendations in terms of the type of existing technology that would provide government an opportunity to leverage immediately and not have to spend a lot of money to develop new proprietary systems?
Ooh, that is a big question. So I think the, you know, WhatsApp, I'm not sure if Facebook has removed the end-to-end encryption yet. I know that Facebook was actively working to get access to the messages that go through there. So it might be encrypted from the perspective of, you know, your cell provider isn't going to be able to listen in on that data as if you had sent an SMS. But it isn't really that private, because at the end of a WhatsApp message is just another person's phone, which is probably unencrypted and just as wide open as anything else. So other apps on that phone that have access to your photos and all of that will have access to that data that's been shared on WhatsApp. So from that perspective, the communication itself might be encrypted, but it's really not on either end. When we think about, you know, how the government engages, how businesses engage, a lot of it comes down to, you know, how do you verify who the person is that you're talking to? That's the problem with phishing. That's the problem with, you know, benefit fraud at the NIB, a lot of these things. It comes down to verifying who the person is. And it's really hard to do that with just photos. So NIST has a great set of standards around identity proofing. You know, how do you prove who somebody is? And they have three different levels. Level one is basically photos, where you don't have a lot of guarantee who somebody is. Level two, you can do remotely, but typically includes video and some other aspects, possibly digital keys, you know, some kind of encrypted data. And level three does still require in-person presence. So, you know, the best that you can really do with technology is level two, but in terms of like the electronic signatures, Electronic Transactions Act here in Trinidad and e-signatures, an assurance level two is completely good enough to comply with all the regulations and to support enrollment into these type of programs. So, you know, Kamla, you made a great point. Not everyone has access to a lot of technology, right? And not everyone has, you know, the ability to go download an app. For some people, that's, you know, more complicated than they can do without assistance. So whatever gets rolled out, you know, I think at least in the very near term needs to be web-based. You still get good encryption on web platforms. And in doing that, you make it accessible to everyone with an internet connected device, right? Which is in Trinidad, you know, not everyone has a data plan, but everyone has Wi-Fi from a neighbor or somebody that they can get online if they have to. And then I guess, Nigel, going back to what you had asked about with, you know, looking at a more central place, I think one of the issues we see, at least from a customer experience side of this, is that every single company who's implementing, you know, a digital engagement strategy has a different way of doing it, which is great, because we see, you know, some really good solutions and some really poor ones. But it's really inconsistent for the customer. They have no idea what to expect or where their data goes. So, you know, finding ways to leverage technology to provide a more consistent experience, I think that's where, you know, distributed ledgers can really help out. One of the key aspects of, you know, distributed ledgers, and like you mentioned, a Bitcoin wallet or any of that stuff, is that you get to create a pair of digital keys. And when you sign with those keys, anyone who receives that data can verify that it was you who signed it. Mm-hmm. And when we think about being able to share PDFs and things like that and know that they weren't tampered with, you know, that's one really good step, is to, you know, digitally encrypt with a pair of keys and send that across. Now, that is, you know, again, probably more technologically complex than it needs to be at this point. And it's a lot to ask everyone, you know, every one of your employees to figure out how to do that and set it up on their machines. but I think there is some technology that's getting out there in the market that makes that a lot easier to access. So when we think about like a central repository or a central way of accessing data or sensitive information, having a more standardized or standards compliant interface that customers and businesses can use to get, you know, access to that stuff is really something we should be moving towards. And again, I think that's a thing that distributed ledgers really have the opportunity to help with.
Okay, thank you very much. Claire, e-commerce, you're on mute.
All right. Thank you very much, Nigel. Okay, as Selby made mention before, one of the biggest challenges that we are seeing is you want to pay your tax, but then it is so difficult. And it is so easy to make it user-friendly where everyone would love to pay their taxes and do business with the government. And I think the online commerce is something that has become critical, especially as we move forward with this pandemic. The banking online system per se, and a lot of the banks right now provide you with that service. If it is that the organization has not yet enlisted, they can start doing that now. The automated clearinghouse or the ACH payments as we know it, those are electronic payments that pull funds directly from your checking account. So I think one of the most important thing here is making sure that that you have sufficient funds within your checking account. If that's the account that you're using, it's better that you have a lot more redundancy than normal, because especially organizations that can be very lean with a lot of liquidity issues, you need to be able to manage that those ACH payments, right? So you don't have to go to the office to write your paper check as you would normally do. So you can initiate a lot of those online payments remotely, which is excellent. You can also have automatic payments that are set up. And even if it is that you may not be paying 100% of the bill at that point in time, you can still set up what you think is a reasonable amount that can be automatically transferred from your account to your supplier or your employees, etc., whatever, that third party. But then you also have your on-demand payments where it is that you're making your daily transactions with the bank. So you're actually online and transferring those funds for payment. That is critical too, because your cash flow, you need to make sure that your clients, your customers are able to make the payments as and when they fall due. So as such, that that ACH arrangement must be inculcated with your customers to make sure that they also embrace that that online banking, that online commerce, right? So the benefits of paying with ACH, you do have a lot of benefits, because as we said before, it is it can be done offline. Even as an individual, because you're online banking right now, once it is that you have been engaging in online banking, there's no reason why your organization cannot embrace that technology. And so there's none whatsoever, right? So the while it makes it easier, you do have to understand some of the challenges that you may have. So it means to say that you're handing over a lot of your confidential information to third parties, because you have to now provide your account number. You'll have to give maybe access to your accounts, etc., and whatnot, so that they can transfer funds to your account. And sometimes we overdo sometimes you overthink the issue, because in truth and in fact, when you do issue a check, your account number is already there, your signature is already there, etc. So I don't think that the challenges outweigh the benefits from that online banking. So as we move forward, I believe that our organization should start embracing. A lot of the banks do offer the service. You do have to set up your approvers. So you have to make sure that in setting up your segregation, who's the one entering the information for the payment, separate from the one who's going to approve, make sure you have double approvers. Those sorts of things you'd really want to ensure are in place. And also, of course, your board approves those persons who are dealing with the operating of the system. One of the key controls that you must have for that online banking is that daily bank reconciliation. That is critical. You can't afford to wait a month and then try to reconcile. You have to reconcile on a daily basis. The banking systems right now, they send you notices immediately a transaction is processed against your account. And having that continuous oversight of your banking transactions that's being done remotely, and especially the automated ones, or the ones where it is that you have a lot more banking fraud taking place. So you want to make sure that bank reconciliation is being done, if not on a daily, on a continuous basis. And I pause. Nigel, over to you. You have to unmute.
That's sorry. Excellent. Nigel, are you there?
I'm here. I was on mute. So what I would like to do is to just wrap up. I don't see any other questions. So Selby, you want to start with the wrap up and we'll go in reverse order?
All right. I will be very brief. One of the observations is that as we move into the technological realm of digital use more predominantly, we need also to think in terms of how do we improve the skills of our people. Mm-hmm. We cannot have this technological transformation without at the same time having a quantum leap in people's skills. And that is something that we must begin to address as an urgent requirement, because I don't think we can escape using the technologies to advance our countries, to advance our businesses, and for the convenience of our people. But we need to think concurrently of upgrading people's skills from a very early age.
Yep. Thank you. Claire?
I would want to follow up with Sally's statement. You have to have a learning organization. You cannot continue just to identify two or three persons or a layer of persons and decide, okay, I am going to expose them to the necessary training in the organization. As we said before, those persons who you train and develop, they can leave your organization, they can drop dead on you, they can be infected with this coronavirus at this point in time. And so as such, you need to be able to inculcate a learning culture in your organization. So that's one. Embracing technology. Some organizations have not been doing it. Small organizations have been looking at the cost of, furthermore, large organizations have been hesitating to embrace technology. If we cannot continue, look for instance, Amazon versus, let's say, Macy's. Amazon will survive. Amazon will survive. But will Macy survive? So as we are moving forward, we have to determine what are some of the critical factors that the organization must adopt. And at this point in time, when a lot of us are home, as from the managers, the directors, etc., and those key professionals that you have in the organization, this is the time that you need to look at the tools that you have in your toolbox. Things like we talked about measuring output and making sure that we achieve the objectives even whilst it is that we are working remotely. But if it is you don't have a balanced scorecard, and if it is you don't have corporate and individual performance management system in place, then how can you do that at this point in time? So that it comes back again to that learning culture and using the technology now to make sure that we have those online training that can take place even as we speak. So workers, I think the organization must carve out a period of time, maybe every week, maybe once a month, as we move forward and target the necessary and critical training and do like what we are doing right now, Zoom it to everybody.
Thank you. So Lewis.
Yeah, thank you, Claire. That was, I just want to build on that even to thinking about the learning organization. It's also, you know, as you educate everyone, you have to empower them to be owners too, right? Giving folks the opportunity to take on responsibilities and, you know, get creative with how they drive value for the business can really, you know, drive employee engagement, especially now when folks are home and you don't have all that social interaction that a lot of us were accustomed to. We found as well really good success with, we just have a Google Hangout that we always use anytime we have a conversation between whoever on the team. We use the same one so that anybody else that happens to pop through, it's kind of like a water cooler. And that's just a fun little way to help folks stay connected. I think as important as it is to skill up all of our people and, you know, get all of our remote working happening, it's also critical that, you know, we have to really start thinking about how our companies exist next year. You know, what is that digital future for a lot of us? How are our goods and services provided to customers? How do we interact with our customers in a year if they still have to stay socially distant and all of our offices haven't opened back? So I think that, you know, while a lot of folks are just trying to figure out how to keep the business running as much as they can right now, it's also imperative to really start, you know, looking at the future and building for that as soon as possible. And maybe that means taking a small team of your, you know, your high performers or whoever, and letting them start, you know, innovating or thinking of new ways that the business can operate. I think that'd be my two contributions there, is just empower your people to create that value.
Thank you very much, Lewis. I think that is really important too. So can we ask Anthony if you can give us your closing statements?
Yeah, sure. So I think more than anything, what mass quarantine has revealed is a digital divide. There are persons who will be able to adapt to new ways of working, and there will be people that won't be able to easily adapt to this new way of working. The same digital divide has manifested in the criminal underworld, and most crimes in the 21st century will be characterized or have some component of cyber and use of technology. That being said, in order to protect ourselves in this new reality, we need to be aware of these types of attacks, and we need to treat online safety exactly the same as we would treat our own physical safety. So that is key going forward. Organizations and persons need to protect themselves in this new reality where digital crime will be increasingly prevalent. I'd also like to direct everyone's attention to the Zoom chat and to Lewis's point regarding companies being aware going forward and knowing exactly how to adjust to working in this new reality. PwC had developed a business, PwC in conjunction with a few of its business continuity specialists, developed a Navigator tool. And the Navigator tool is essentially a questionnaire designed to help employees assess whether they could or have the relevant plans and controls in place to address any business continuity concerns. So the link to that survey is included in the chat, and I hope everyone participates. It's a really helpful survey.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Anthony. I found really that today's discussion was so important and critical for us to start thinking about in terms of so many of us having no choice really, because if you are in a stay-at-home situation where government is saying we need to not congregate, then we have no choice but to move online and using the web platforms, which would then allow us to be able to continue to function. But I think today's conversation really helped bring a lot of awareness that we cannot take for granted, that there are some things that you can do and there may not be consequences. So for instance, even with my insurance company, you know, they were asking, can you send a copy of your ID online? And without thinking, you know, you snap a picture and you send it on WhatsApp. I think it's important for us to start thinking of what are the ways we can separate our pieces of information. So it makes it more difficult for people to be able to access it. But at the same time, too, also being able to use those technologies which already exist, so that there are existing security features and measures that would allow us to be able to work in a safe environment. But I think the idea of training and awareness of the user, that I think was also an excellent point today. And all of us should take the time to be able to go online and gain some training as well to build our awareness and competence so that we don't end up having one of those stories, the one that Anthony shared with respect to someone who hack into your account and sit for months studying your behavior and then could really legitimately attack you and get $1 million. I mean, that is a scary thought. So possibly one of the things we need to keep in mind is using tools like Zoom, of course, so you can see the individual you were speaking with, picking up the phone and making a call to ensure that the email which reached you was from the individual who claims. So those are things that can be really helpful in taking us forward in this new environment so that we would be comfortable to be able to move forward. Just checking quickly to see if Nigel is
back. I'm here.
Right. Great. So, Nigel, I'd let you wrap up. I will add just one piece, which is to say we are continuing our discussions tomorrow. We'll be continuing to look at the impact of COVID-19 on our employees. So we're looking at the HR perspective. I'm hoping to have someone from the ECA talk to us about companies who may need to reduce the numbers of workers in the next month or two if we continue to have to stay at home. Also, next week, Wednesday, we would have representatives from the labor movement where we would be trying to get the trade union perspective to guide us in terms of what are the things that are allowed that they will support us in getting labor to move with us. So that's next week, Wednesday. So I'll give it back to you, Nigel, for close up today.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all the panelists, Claire, Anthony, Lewis, and of course, Selby, for their very, very insightful comments. I think they addressed all the questions. Let's be clear, we are not going back. This is a sea change in how we're going to be interacting, how we're going to be working, how we're going to be doing commerce. And we need to understand, as the environment shifts, as the technology shifts, we need to be ahead of the game. As Claire said, it's all about the learning organization. I'd like to say it's also having a growth mindset, a mindset that where you see where you are today, as not static. It's not a fixed mindset. It's about learning and growth and constantly taking risk, but taking intelligent risk and learning as you go. So I hope the participants are leaving with more knowledge and more awareness, and that they will take advantage of the various links shared to continue learning. We are here to, as directors, as senior managers, to protect the long-term existence of the organizations that we serve. And we will do so by ensuring that we stay ahead of the game, understanding how the landscape is changing and the risk that we have to understand and manage as we move forward. So again, thank you all very much. Great stuff. It's always a pleasure working with Anthony and Lewis. They keep me young, you know, and I like the idea of staying young. So thank you all very much. Kamla, over to you.
Yes, great. Thank you very much, Nigel. Thank you. Thank you to all the board members of CCGI for the support and ensuring that we are really relevant and continuing to provide this kind of forum. And a sincere appreciation to all our panelists. We've been having some really, really great sessions that I think is helping all of us to understand that, you know, as the change continues, some of which we really can't anticipate, but we can help each other with sharing our knowledge and experiences and our ideas and how we can cook. So thank you guys, truly appreciate it. And I look forward to everyone continuing to join us every week. Remember, we are on twice weekly, Wednesdays 9 to 10, and also on Thursdays from 10 to 11 a.m. as we continue to discuss the governance impact on COVID-19 for all of us. So thank you and have a wonderful day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Kamla. Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good day.